Are here other than hikes, and we're glad to be here, and we thank the leadership of B'nai Yeshurun at this point for taking us in also. So today we're very pleased to have, and it's very fitting now that we're part of B'nai Yeshurun to have the rabbi of B'nai Yeshurun. So we're very happy to have with us today Rabbi Prezansky, who's been the Mora D'Asra of B'nai Yeshurun now for 24 years. Since August of 1994. Rabbi Prezansky graduated from Columbia University in 1978 with a BA in history, which I didn't know, by the way, but when he speaks about history, you'll see he's brilliant. He knows everything about history. Ask him any question.
That's for sure. don't set me up for failure.
At least when he speaks on those topics, he knows. And this is sort of a historical event. Hanukkah is a historical event. Rabbi Prezansky received his J.D. degree, his law degree, from the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law in 1981. He practiced for 13 law years as a general practitioner and litigator in New York City until assuming his current pulpit. Actually, he had a previous pulpit before here. But, you know, the shuls were able to pry him away from the law and become a rabbi. And he's a member of the New York and Federal Bars. He's admitted to practice before the U.S. Supreme Court. Lots of other credentials, which I won't go into the long list. I will just mention that Rabbi Prezansky recently published this book, one of many books that he's published, called Sotka Mimeni, The Jewish Ethic of Personal Responsibility, just came out recently.
Volume 2.
And if anyone is interested after the session in buying a copy of one of these, I'm sure Rabbi Prezansky would be happy to sell it to you and autograph it. So with that, it's a great privilege to introduce Rabbi Prezansky.
Thank you. To auction it off would be even better, by the way. I'll let Mike be the auctioneer. All right, it's nice to see you. You know, I'm not used to using a microphone in such a small room, but you'll let me know if it's really necessary. I want to thank Michael Carlin for the invitation and for his really hard work in the Teaneck Orthodox Retirees Association, and thank him for the kind introduction. It's always better to lower expectations than to raise expectations. Speaking of which, all of you retired the last few years, and then the economy boomed. What does that tell you? Just joking. So, the topic today, Hanukkah, the untold story. I chose, I think, a month or two with Michael to give me maximum flexibility. The truth is, I had no idea what I was going to talk about. It's untold until now. Once I tell it, it'll be told again the way I'm telling it. So it's a very good title. What is it that we know about Hanukkah? I mean, the basic story involves the land of Israel being dominated by Syrian Greek Hellenists, they captured and desecrated the Beis HaMikdash. They persecuted the Jews. They forcibly prevented them from observing certain mitzvos until at a certain point, a small band of rebels, the Maccabim, later the Hashmonim was their name, revolted, defeated the larger, more powerful Syrian army, liberated and cleansed the Beis HaMikdash, found one jug of oil that had not been defiled by the Syrians, and lit the menorah that burned for how many days? Someone? 8 days, of course. You get the prize. And then drove the Syrians from the land of Israel and established a monarchy that lasted more than 200 years. That's the gist of it. But really, in that synopsis, the essence of the struggle is really missing from that tale. The challenges, the dangers, the fears, and especially the relevance to today. Of course, there were worse expositions of the story, that it was a fight for religious liberty, a fight for Jewish statehood, a fight for democracy and freedom of expression, a fight against tyranny and occupation, a fight for pluralism, etc. If you look at modern versions of the Hanukkah story, all of those appear in one form or the other, ranging from caricatures of the Hanukkah story to really ridiculous, but overall, ha'ikar chasam in ha'sefer, what's essence is missing. So what happened, and why does it remain eternally relevant? I want to start just with the Rambam's overview of the story of Hanukkah, and how he phrases it, and what he includes and what he doesn't include will guide us as we go along. B'vayesheni k'shemolchu Yavon, during the Second Temple era, when the Greeks reigned, gazru gzeres al Yisrael, ubatlu dasam. They issued decrees against the Jewish people, and they tried to nullify their faith. V'hinicho samlasok b'tor v'mitzvos. They didn't let us do the mitzvah, study Torah. Upashtu yadam b'mamonam. They plundered our wealth. Uvivnosehem, and our daughters. V'nichnesu leichal. They entered the Beis HaMikdash. Upartzu bo pratzos v'timu ataros. And they made many breaches in the Beis HaMikdash, meaning opened it to everyone, and they desecrated, they defiled what was pure. V'tzar lahem li Yisrael me'od mipneihem, and the Jewish people were deeply persecuted, aggrieved by them. U'lachatzum lachatz gadol, and they applied tremendous pressure against us. Acherichem aleihem elokev oseinu v'oshiyom yadom, until God had, the God of our fathers, had mercy on us and saved us from their hands. V'tzilom v'gavru b'nei hashmonai hakonim agadolim, and the children of the hashmonoim, the great kohanim, prevailed. Varagum, kill the enemy. V'oshiyu Yisrael miyadom, save the Jewish people from their hands. V'emidu melech min hakonim, and they established a king from amongst the kohanim, which was forbidden, by the way. V'chazru malchus Yisrael yaser al masayim shana ad ha'churban hasheni, and the monarchy returned to the Jewish people for more than 200 years until the second Churban Beis HaMikdash. That's how the Rambam says it. Note in this is the first paragraph. It's Paragim Halacha Aleph. Rambam says nothing about the miracle of the menorah, but nor does he really explain, it's not his purpose, frankly, how the war came about, how we got ourselves into this situation, and how we extricated ourselves, and how long it took. And that really is our subject for today. I want to note at first that Hanukkah is the last holiday that we have chronologically, meaning if the first holiday is Pesach in time, because that's when we left Egypt, the last holiday that was decreed in time is Hanukkah. It's the only one that doesn't appear in Tanakh. Of course, the one right before, which is a little over two and a half centuries before, was Purim. And Hanukkah rose after the sealing of the Tanakh, so it's not going to be part of Tanakh. So it does leave the story of Hanukkah somewhat murky. But nonetheless, it also leaves us with an eternal message about what life in the exile was going to be, the last holiday before the long exile, about what life in darkness would be, and the threats that we would face, and that we'd have to overcome, and that we have overcome, and the secret of Jewish survival, and the secret of light. So, as the Gemara says, my Hanukkah, what exactly is Hanukkah all about? The many fine works written in the last 20, 30 years that tell the story. After a long period of time in which we just focused on the events right before, during, and right after the miracle in the Beis HaMikdash. So I'm relying in large part on a book I got as a gift a few years ago, written by Aryeh Pinchas Strikoff of, I think he lives in Cleveland, called Inside Hanukkah. He's actually the nephew of our own Marilyn and Joey Bench, and the Benches gave me a safer a few years ago. And he himself cites other works, Rabbi Wein's works, or Hirsch Goldworm's works, and others as well. And they present a narrative of the events that led up to and followed Hanukkah that I think give us a different perspective on the story. So we could start with the Churban, of course, the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, but really later as well. The second Beis HaMikdash was built during the reign of Darius, of Daryovesh, who was the son of Esther HaMalka and Ahasuerus. in the year 3408 from creation, 353 before the Common Era. Now, of course, we know there's a controversy and a problem with the dates that exist. The secular dates do not conform to the Torah dates. That's not really our purpose today in any event. So we'll just use the Torah dates that we have. In the ensuing decades after the building of the Beis HaMikdash, Ezra would come to Israel, Nehemiah would come to Israel, the Tanakh would be canonized by the newly formed Anshei Knesset HaGdola, 120 men set aside to establish a new routine in the second Beis HaMikdash era, and that would soon morph into the Sanhedrin. In the year 313 before the Common Era, Darius, not Esther's son, but really Esther's grandson, and much of Persia, and much of the world, were conquered by Alexander the Great of Macedonia, Alexander Mokdon. So Darius, in fact, did not have a long reign. I mean, he died before the overthrow, but Alexander conquered most of the world, and he conquered Israel as well. And at that time, he was informed by the Kutim, the Samaritans, that the Jews were planning to rebel against him, and that the seat of their rebellion is in the Beis HaMikdash. Alexander the Great then begins to march on the land of Israel for the purpose of establishing his harsh rule there and destroying the Beis HaMikdash. And then the famous story begins. And you know, all these stories are scattered through the Talmud, but when they're pieced together, it becomes very fascinating. This is the Gemara Yoma Daf Samech Tes Amud Aleph. So the Gemara says the 25th of Teves is called Yom HaGrizim Delila Misbeit. It was a minor holiday on which eulogies were not allowed. It was the day, I'm just translating for the Gemara, that the Kusim, the Samaritans, tried to induce Alexander the Great to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Shimon HaTzadik, as the Mishnah says, Mishayore Anshe Knesset HaGdola, one of the remnants of the first 120 members of the men of the Great Assembly. He was the Kohen Gadol at the time, Kohen Gadol for 40 years. He found out about it. So what did he do? As the Gemara says, he dressed in his big day kahuna. He covered himself, and of course, Big Day Kahuna, the Kohen Gadol's garments, are resplendent, regal, colorful, magisterial. And he took the notables, the leaders of Israel, and they carried with them avukoshel or, torches. And the entire night they traveled north to meet, to intercept Alexander the Great before he would speak to the Samaritans. When dawn reigned, they had arrived at his camp, and he asked, "Mi halalu? Who are these people?" And they told him, "Yehudim shemardu b'cha. These are the Jews who are rebelling against you." When he came to Antipatris in the north of the country, the sun rose, upagu zebazeh. The two men, their eyes caught, Shimon HaTzadik and Alexander the Great. Kevin Sharol Shimon HaTzadik, when Alexander saw Shimon, he descended from his chariot, Vishtachal Velifonov, and he bowed down before Shimon HaTzadik. And they said to him, Melach Gadol Kamoscha, Yishtachavel Lihudi Zeh, a great king like you is going to bow down to this Jew? Omar Lahem, as Alexander said, Demus Diokono Shozeh, whenever I go to battle, for some reason, then unknown to him, I have an image in my unconscious of this man. Why, I don't know. But now I see his face. That's the face that accompanies me into my victorious battles. Amar Lahem, now he said to the Jews, Lama Basem, why did you come? So Shimon HaTzadik said, Efshir Bayis, is it possible that in the very house, the very temple in which they pray for you and for your kingdom, that it should not be destroyed, yitaucha goyim achrivo, you're going to be induced, misled by non-Jews to destroy it, it's counterproductive. He said, mi alalu, who wants to upset my monarchy? And Shimon said, it's kutiim halalu shomdu lefanecha. It's these Samaritans that are really your enemy. Crisis was averted. Samaritans were given over to Shimon HaTzadik for disposition. It was not pretty. Alexander the Great became a hero to the Jewish people until today. So the decree was passed by the Sanhedrin that year, the year after this, it was Chaf Hei Teves, for the next year, any male child that was born would be named Alexander. And in fact, that name, Alexander, despite being a Greek name, is a name used by Jews until today. So you think how long goes back? It goes back about 24 centuries that Alexander is a Jewish name. Some names have fallen out of use, you know, that you see even in the Talmud. Like Yishmael, for example. You know any Jew named Yishmael? I don't mean Esav or Amon, but Yishmael. There was a great Tanner of Yishmael, was a kind gadol. But you don't find Yishmael used. Alexander is still used. Alexander the Great died 6 years later. He was age 32. Under mysterious circumstances, some people still investigating his death. Liable not to come to any real resolution. Some say he was poisoned. Others say he drank himself to death. Others that he just became ill and died. Very interestingly, like Christopher Columbus, Alexander's tomb is claimed in several parts of the world. Macedonia, Egypt, Babylon, with tourist sites claiming it's his grave, but of course most people can have only one grave. Columbus the same way. They claim he's buried in Spain, in Italy, in Egypt, and even in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. Alexander's legacy is more clear. His conquests, most of the world, were divided among his three generals. Antigonus, who took the northern part, Greece and Macedonia. Ptolemy, another general, Ptolemy in our lexicon, Ptolemy, was given Egypt, or took Egypt and North Africa. And the third general, Seleucus, took Syria and Bavel. What's not mentioned? The land of Israel. So for decades after this, Ptolemy and Seleucus fought over rights to the land of Israel. Now, Alexander the Great did not just conquer nations and territory. He brought to it Greek culture. That is why, ad hayom, until today, there's so many places in the Middle East with Greek architecture that you could still find. The best way, he felt, to keep the natives at bay, in essence, was to make them feel part of a broader whole. So Hellenism began to sweep the world, including the land of Israel. How much so? Well, consider that Shimon HaTzadik outlived Alexander the Great by about 28 years. Shimon HaTzadik died in 279 of the Common Era. Who succeeded him as Av Beis Din? Oh, we know this from the first parak of Avos. Who succeeded Shimon HaTzadik? Antigonos Ish Socho. All right? I only mention that name, so if you think about it, the head of the Sanhedrin, all right, had the same name, Antigonus, as one of Alexander's generals. It's like having a rabbi named Stephen. Something doesn't compute. Is that really a Jewish name? Moreover, in the year 246 BCE, Talmai's son, forced 72 sages to translate the Torah into Greek, creating the Targum Shivan, the Septuagint. So it's a dark moment. Chazal were against it, and they saw the danger. Among other things, because now the world had, it thought, access to the wisdom of the Jews. But they really didn't with that Torah Shebaal Peh. Worse, the Torah now assumed the status of literature. It's on the library shelves, like any other book, completely shorn of the mystique, of its mystique, as the word of Hashem. So this hurt the Jewish people enormously, and led to the infiltration of Greek ideas into Jewish society. So what exactly are those ideas? What were those ideas? You can turn the phone off. It's not davening now. It's different. So what were those ideas that so changed the world and influenced man and really set the stage for the story of Hanukkah as well? Well, Chazal perceived Greek wisdom as a great challenge to Torah. Really the first intellectual, ideological challenge to Torah since the Torah was given to us at Sinai. For the simple reason that we never put much stock in paganism, in idolatry. I don't think Jews really believed it at any point in history. Even the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that when they worshipped the Egel Azov, Jews always knew about idolatry, Shem Ba Mamish, there's no substance to it. But rather they found these mechanisms, Kedei Latir Lehem Aroyos B'Ferhesya. They wanted to engage in public promiscuity, and it's nice to have a system to justify it. So idolatry, paganism, was a system. They knew there was nothing to it. But if a Jew wanted to sin, he could say, well, I'm a follower of Baal. And that's what we do. That's our stock in trade. Greek culture emphasized the physical, the material. It glorified nature. But Chazal perceived it as a threat primarily because it was perceived as sophisticated, as offering a derech hachayim, a way of life, that at least, as it was reflected in the works of the classic Greek philosophers, was based on reason and pursuit of knowledge, and even had its own value system. And it wasn't just Plato and Aristotle and Socrates the Elder. You know, they lived at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash era, so they were long gone by this time. But those works continued. Those works were prized by the Greeks. Their understanding of ethics, of government, and especially the purpose of life. So they were gone, although there was they left a legacy, but contemporaneous to this time that we're talking about, with the Talmai and Shimon HaTzadik and Antigonus of Socho, lived another famous Greek philosopher, actually who opposed the Platonic doctrines, named Epicurus, all right, from which we derive the word Apicurus. Now Epicurus, he died in 270 before the Common Era. He saw the purpose of life as the pursuit of pleasure, and as the avoidance of pain, seeking the company of friends, like you have here today. What are we talking about? The company of friends, good food, all right? Only pain is my speaking, so it's not a bad life. To Epicurus, pleasure was a moral good. So it's summarizing the phrase, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die, but it's something, he never really said that, and it's actually an oversimplification of his thought. The gist of that idea, by the way, is in Koheles, where Shlomo HaMelech says that as a hypothesis that he rejects. But nonetheless, that is his point. Unlike Plato, Epicurus extolled the life of the senses, not a life of reason. Note, by the way, parenthetically, that we want to refer to a heretic, we don't call him an Aflatone, all right? A Plato. We call him an Apicurus, a foe of Epicurus. Because in essence, like the Gemara in Sanhedrin I cited a few moments ago, we don't really put much stock in a Jew finding an ideological or philosophical system that happens to justify what he or she wants to do, all right, how she wants to live, and what type of sin he wants to commit. That really was Epicurus. He, you had a person. It's a great thinker, by the way. I think a lot of his philosophy is distorted later on, but the essence of it is a philosophy. Pursue pleasure, avoid pain, be a good person, make friends, and that's the good life. That's a good life, but that's not the life of Torah. And from Plato's perspective, of course, that's not even life of reason. Plato was much more in tune with moderation in the pursuit of sensual pleasure, not Epicurus. Worse, of course, this Chochmas Yevonis, this Greek wisdom, was not based on revelation at all obviously, but was man-made. It afforded people a pleasurable life and was a system, and that's the key. It wasn't just haphazard, go with the flow, hakol zareim, I'll do what I want and I'll let the lawyers get me out of it. No, it had an allure because great thinkers, great people subscribed to it. Many Jews fell for it also because they saw, well, this Torah, which advocates one way of life, but now there's Yavanis, Hellenism, which advocates a different way of life, that has its attractions as well. It swept the world as a result, because the world is always looking to move beyond paganism. Paganism has its hold even today. But once people start thinking a little more, the pagan has less of an attraction. This is what Chazal had in mind, by the way, in the famous saying that you find in the Medrash in Eicha, Im yomer lecha adam yesh chochma bagoyim tamin. If someone says to you there's wisdom amongst the nations, believe it. But if they say yesh Torah bagoyim, al tamin. If the nations have Torah, don't believe that. Torah is a moral system, not just an intellectual system. And I think the difference is underscored by something I said Shabbos afternoon in a shiur that I gave on Greek wisdom, something that unfortunately I could not record as I'm doing now. Reb Chaim Friedlander was the great mashgiach of the Ponovitch Yeshiva. And he said very concisely, distinguishing between Torah and Greek wisdom, that the purpose of Torah is to make us better people. The purpose of studying Torah is not to make us wise, but to make us good. The purpose of chachma, of wisdom, is to make people wise, but not necessarily good. And we do know the difference very well. There's no correlation between wisdom and goodness. Reb Chaim Friedlander has a whole paragraph he spends talking about Nazi Germany, where it's obvious there's no correlation between wisdom and goodness at all. So the Greeks didn't oppose Torah as a source of wisdom. They opposed the Torah as a source of divine morality, especially as a binding source of divine morality. We should not underestimate the appeal of Hellenism. It's easy for us to do. You visit Athens and go to the Acropolis, and it's all in ruins, and you wonder what type of society they had then. No, it was very attractive. The first casualties that we know of were the disciples of Antigonos Ishsocho. Who were they? Tzadok and Baisos, the founder of two different schools, the Tzadokim, we call the Sadducees, and the Baitusim. And they posited, they denied divine providence, they denied Schar Va'onesh. In other words, they posited a religion without a God who compels ethical behavior. Just do whatever you want. Hellenism swept the world, including the land of Israel, and as the people learned the Greek language, so Greek culture and values were open before them as well. We can relate to this more than you would think on the surface. Think for a moment about the attraction of the Enlightenment and how it induced so many Jews. All right, no one is that old that you go back to the early 19th century. But think back to how Jews, when they left the ghetto and they and went to university in Europe, and they encountered for the first time non-Jews who were not barbarians, how quickly they fell, swept away by the Enlightenment, by socialism, which on its surface has attractive ideas as well, by communism, all right? How attractive is socialism, by the way? It's making a comeback, all right? You know, it'll make a comeback. I'm sure it'll grow a little, and then it'll start to diminish again. You know, it's like Margaret Thatcher said, that socialism works until you run out of other people's money. Then you have to go back to capitalism, try to get some more money to fund your socialist fantasies. But communism even more. How many Jews 100 years ago fell to communism? All right, the Talmidim who left yeshiva, ran from Volozhin to become socialists and revolutionaries. The Talmidim who ran to become communists, to try to overthrow the Tsar. And it didn't even end with World War II. I myself remember in my father's shul in the Bronx, there was a communist. And I remember once my father was speaking, he was, I think, denouncing, at the time it was Kosygin, either for Israel, the Soviet Jews, whatever it was, the mid-60s. And this guy got up and walked out. All right, I'm not the only one in the family it's happened to. Have my father also. So I asked my father, little kid, I asked my father afterwards, what happened? Why did he walk out? He said, oh, he's a communist. He cannot abide any criticism of the leader of the Soviet Union or anything they do. Probably 7, 8 years old at the time. The hold that communism had on Jews, I don't think was as strong as the hold that Hellenism had on Jews. And you add to that, you see, today there are a number of isms floating through our society as well. And the pattern always is that Jews will first try to adapt the Torah to them. And then when that doesn't work, they'll abandon the Torah with a vengeance, especially a vengeance against those who retain allegiance to it. Think of communism and how they thought they'd transform the world, make it a world of peace and brotherhood, etc. And those who were holding on to the old world were frustrating that ideal. That's where the hatred came from. But we just understand the recent ideologies that have so energized or animated or enthused numbers of Jews, maybe we can understand some of the fascination that existed with Hellenism as well. And then the war broke out. The Egyptian Greeks, with the heirs to the first Ptolemy, ruled Israel from Alexander's time until the year 199 before the Common Era, when Antiochus III, who was a descendant of Seleucus, conquered Israel from Ptolemy V. Antiochus III was actually a benevolent ruler by those standards, but that changed with his son, Seleucus IV, 187 BCE, and then after Seleucus was murdered in 175 BCE, he was succeeded by his insane brother, and that's Antiochus IV of our Hanukkah story. Antiochus established as his goal the expansion of Greek culture throughout his captured territories, including in the land of Israel. And he had help as well. Who helped him? Well, in the land of Israel was the Jews. Too many Jews. So this we know from the Gemara in Yom Daf Tes Amud Aleph. The Gemara says, asking about the great number of Kohanim Gadolim, of high priests that existed in the second base of Mikdash. So the Gemara says, Mikdash Sheni, the second Mikdash, stood for 420 years and had more than 300 Kohanim Gadolim. How's that possible? And the Gemara continues, you have to exclude 40 years of Shimon HaTzadik, 80 years of Yochanan Kohen Gadol, and 10 years Yishmael ben Favi, another 11 years of Reb Elazar ben Charsom. Mikan ve'eilach tzevach hashov, kol echad ve'echad lo hotzi shnoso. Most of the other Kohanim Gadolim did not live out the year. Alright? Meaning, they were Hellenists. They were not really believers. Many were Sadducees as well. They followed a literal order of what the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Kodesh HaKodashim, the Holy of Holies, is supposed to be on Yom HaKippurim. And as we know, the penalty for non-compliance is death. They didn't live out the year. You know, I don't want to get too far afield, but there's an amazing statement that the Gemara makes, that a father said to his son, who is now the Kohen Gadol, that, you know, your predecessors don't seem to have longevity. All right? So maybe when you go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom HaKippurim, whether you believe it or not, man, stick with the program. All right, do what the Torah says, what Chazal say to do, and you'll live. So he said to his father, I'm trying to recall the phrase exactly, Efsha mitzvah bo liyodi v'lo akaymeno. Is it possible that this mitzvah will fall into my hands and I will not fulfill it? Meaning the mitzvah in his mind of following the Sadducees. What does that phrase ring? The phrase should ring a bell? It's exactly what Rabbi Akiva said when he's being tortured to death by the Romans. His Talmidim asked him why he's happy. See, he said the exact same words. Efshar mitzvah bo liyodi, the mitzvah of giving my life, al kiddush Hashem, is falling into my hands. V'lo akaimeno, I won't fulfill it. Think about it. Same phrase was used by Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, with everything it means to us. But 2 centuries earlier, 2.5 centuries, the phrase was used by a Sadducee priest. That's how much, that's how true believers are. That's how much Hellenism swept the Jewish people, and the Sadducees threatened to overwhelm the world of Torah. So many of the Kohanim Gedolim were Hellenists who attained the position through bribery. That happened here as well. Now, in the 170s, the reigning Kohen Gadol was named Chonyo III, actually a pious Jew, but he was replaced by his brother Jason, who was a Hellenist, Yason, who bribed Antiochus into the position. Most acquired their positions that way. Jason built a gymnasium in Yerushalayim, where they conducted nude sports, sacrificed animals there to the god, and then he had a side job, in the Beis HaMikdash also. He was the first to encourage the reversal of Mila. What do we know about him? Jason? His tomb is in Rehavia, Kever Yason, on Rehov Alfasi. All right, what's that? Yeah. You can see it. It's a site. It's usually closed because, who's going to visit there? The guy was a Russia gomor, but he built a nice tomb for himself. Kever Yason, it's called. Worse, he was soon replaced by a bigger briber, all right? I said about an honest politician. What's an honest politician? When he's bought, he stays bought. Well, Antiochus was not like that. Jason bribed him, but his successor, Menelaus, bribed him with a bigger bribe, so he lost his position. So Menelaus took over. Menelaus murdered Chonyo III. The situation deteriorated even more with Antiochus preoccupied with a war with Egypt. Jason seized the Kohen Gadol again, massacred many Jews in Yerushalayim whom he thought supported him insufficiently in his struggle with Menelaus. But then Antiochus came back and Menelaus was restored. Antiochus killed even more people in Yerushalayim, entered the Beis HaMikdash, seized its golden and silver vessels, and now we're in the year 169 before the Common Era. And then Antiochus began the process of intense Hellenization to root out the service in the Beis HaMikdash, to stamp out the mitzvahs that made Jews unique, Shabbos, Kashrus, Mila, Rosh Chodesh, Taras HaMishpacha, and of course Talmud Torah. In 168 BCE, Syrian forces under the leadership of the general Apollonius entered the Beis HaMikdash, halted the Avodah, and on the 17th day of Tammuz, as the Mishnah tells us in Tainis, Visaraf Apostamos es HaTorah v'ha'amid selem b'aychal. Apostamos burned the Sefer Torah. The different opinions. Some say it was the Torah that Ezra HaSofer had written. Others say he just gathered any Torah he could find and burned them all. He put an idol in the Beis HaMikdash on the 25th of Kislev that year. Remember the date? 168 before the Common Era. Pigs were sacrificed on the Mizbeach. And the real tyranny began. Faithful Jews fled Yerushalayim for their lives. One family, Matisyo and his 5 sons, Yehuda, Shimon, Elazar, Yochanan, Yonatan, fled to Modi'in, which became the center of the resistance of the revolt, which began almost immediately after the defilement of the Beis HaMikdash. And Modi, where I spend a lot of time, there's an area there that's known as the Chashmonoi village, all right, ruins of an ancient Chashmonoi village that was there. You still visit it today. And every Erev Shabbos Chanukah, it's a custom going back to when Modi'in was reestablished a little over 20 years ago, people go there to daven Kabbalah Shabbos and to light near Hanukkah there in the ruins of the ancient Chashmonoi village, except if it rains, which happened the one time I thought to go, nobody was there because of the rain. Matisyahu fled to Modi'in, and at a certain point, almost immediately, because of the process of Hellenization, a group of Antiochus' soldiers came to Modi'in, attempted to force Matisyahu to offer a pig as a sacrifice. He refused, but a Hellenist Jew stepped forward to offer that sacrifice, and Matisyahu killed him on the spot. So much for freedom of worship. But of course, that began the revolt in earnest. Word traveled fast to the surrounding villages with the clarion call, Mil Hashem Eli. Very few Jews responded. And that's another sad aspect of Hanukkah, which engenders one of the more mysterious and troubling aspects of the Hanukkah story. In Al HaNisim, we praise God for the victory. One of the things we say is that it was a victory of Rabim Biyad Me'atim, the many given over into the hands of the few. But why should the Maccabim have the few? Almost by definition, they're in their home country. An indigenous revolution always outnumbers the foreign occupiers. Think, for example, of the American Revolution. All right, they were loyalists in America too, to be sure. Like they were British here also, but obviously the colonists outnumbered them because it's their country. They're going to be the majority. Same thing when Israel overthrew the British in the mid-1940s. Obviously, there'd be more Jews than Brits there. How could it be Rabim Biyad Matim? How could the indigenous population be the minority? And the answer is because most Jews were Hellenists. And many of them fought with Antiochus. So the good guys were the Matim. And the war of Hanukkah was as much a civil war between Jews, sadly, as it was a war against Hellenism and the purification of the Beis HaMikdash. Matisyahu died in 167 BC, just less than a year after the revolt began. He died of natural causes, but the war went on. It was a guerrilla war, necessitated by the fact that the Maccabim were so few in number. So first, Apollonius' army was surprised and routed near Shechem. These sites, by the way, more or less identified because they came up, or came down afterwards, Route 60, which is now the road that takes you from Jenin all the way to south of Hebron. It's only one major road that's existed since antiquity. The battle was off the road. Second battle was in Beit Horon, which is on a hilltop overlooking Modi'in. And then at Mitzpah, right north of Yerushalayim. Yehuda's army, for the most part, never exceeded 5,000 men. And most battles were fought with regiments of 1,000 against enemy forces that numbered in the tens of thousands and were equipped with the tanks of the day. Battle elephants. It's very hard to topple an elephant. And as we know from the Book of the Maccabim, on the day of the battle, it was a pious army. The men would daven and fast. I should mention Agav Urcha. One outcome of this is that when the Greek army was overriding the Jews, they would hide in caves to avoid them, and they would be attacked on Shabbos and not fight back on Shabbos because of the fear of Chil Shabbos. And as we see in the Gemara, it was the Beis Din L'Chashmonaim that ruled that Pikuach Nefesh is Doche Shabbos, that you can fight as well on Shabbos, and that is the norm until today. The climactic battle would be fought in Kislev in the year 165 before the Common Era, in Gush Etzion, in Beit Tzur. Yehuda's army, the largest he had, 10,000, fighting a Syrian army of 60,000 infantrymen and 5,000 cavalry. The war was won, or the battle was won, on the 24th of Kislev. So Yehuda and his brothers, they killed some 5,000 soldiers. The rest fled, and they then ascended to Yerushalayim, and they found the Beis HaMikdash desolate and in ruins, and they began the process of cleansing it. They had to make all new kelim, of course, and they had to rebuild the Mizbeach, with new stones. It had been defiled. And they also constructed a menorah out of iron rods, which was the only metal to which they had access. It's interesting. I have one at home, actually. But I was in Sderot 10 days ago, and they have on the rooftop of a yeshiva a menorah that they've made out of mortar shells that have landed in Sderot from the Arabs in the last 20 years. And it's actually a beautiful sight. You have 8 mortars with the shamash in the middle, and it stands on top. So they light that at night, so they should see it in Gaza. So they took their rockets and made a menorah out of it. I was given a gift. I have one of those at home myself. A missile menorah, I call it. In the late afternoon, on the 24th of Kislev, they found one jug of oil with a seal of the Kohen Gadol. They lit the menorah, and it burned for how many days?
8 days.
Ah, so now you got it. 8 days. For the next year, it was quiet. And the Beis HaMikdash was repaired, was renovated, began to function fully. And as the Gemara tells us, Lashon Acheres, a year later, and the Sanhedrin saw the results, they established this as a holiday. But it's not very well known. The war continued. Only a small part of the land of Israel had been liberated. The Modi'in area, Yerushalayim area, not even completely, and south of Gush Etzion, a little north as well. The Syrians still controlled much of the land. In fact, the Hellenist Jews still remained for many years in a fortress that was right north of the Beis HaMikdash, in today what we call the old city of Yerushalayim. In the ensuing battles that took place, the sons of Matisyo were killed almost one by one. First Elazar, where was he killed? Well, Gush Etzion, where he was killed, is the Yeshuv Elazar, his name for him. Yehuda HaMakabi was killed in the year 160, and again the Jewish Hellenists were on the ascendant. The war continued for 25 years. After Hanukkah, after the story of Hanukkah, until the final victory of the only survivor of Matisyo, his son Shimon, who declared himself king, having routed the Syrian Hellenists. And he began the Hashmonaim dynasty in the year 141 before the Common Era. And between the Hashmonaim dynasty and its successor, to some extent, the Herodian dynasty, those are the more than 200 years to which the Rambam refers. So Hanukkah wasn't as much a war for freedom as much as it was a war for Tahara, for Kedusha, for purity, for holiness, a war for the Masorah, for Jewish tradition. It was a war with weapons that was fought, though, to eradicate an alien philosophy that had taken root in too many Jews. That's why the miracle of Hanukkah, I mentioned the other night, the nace of the menorah, is really the symbol and the key to understanding Hanukkah. This Reb Chaim Friedland said as well, proof that the Shechina resides in the land of Israel. Because as we know, the menorah, the Beis HaMikdash, the Ner Ma'aravi, always burnt. It was never extinguished. A sign, aidless to the nations of the world, that the God of Israel is alive and well and looking over us. It wasn't a war about the land of Israel, as moderns will tell us. Because in fact, when the Hanukkah story, when Hanukkah holiday was established, we didn't possess most of the land of Israel. It was still occupied by the Syrians. Hanukkah was a triumph over the ideology that sees the primacy of reason and the rule of nature as the foundations of life. And what prevailed over that was those who see our mission in life and the purpose of our existence to make the world better, to make the world more moral, to make the world more aware of the higher authority, capital H, capital A, of the creator of us all, who gave us the Torah and preserves us until today, which we now celebrate, Lehodos ulahalel l'shimcha hagadol, to give thanks and to give praise to his great name. I thank you all for coming, for your kind attention as well. I like that applause. We should encourage a Shabbos morning also.